Life,
a podcast of the cinema,
starring Alonzo Duralde. That's not me.
That is me.
That's you.
It's me.
Who? What do you do?
So many things. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap, and I co-host the Breakfast All Day, Who Shot Ya, a film and a movie, and occasionally Deck the Hallmark podcasts.
Not occasionally now.
Weekly.
You are now a regular weekly.
Yes.
Fourth person.
Mm-hmm.
One day a week. Because
yes.
They've gone 5 days a week.
They've gone 5 days a week.
Your life is one giant podcast. Now,
kind of, yeah.
In addition to being an employed working film critic,
mm-hmm.
which is an increasingly rare proposition.
No question. Yeah.
In the United States in the pandemic. Who am I?
You are Dave White. You are an esteemed film critic and podcaster.
Yes. Esteemed.
So much. Esteemed clams.
Unemployed and esteemed. And I need to know something.
Yes.
You can tell me. It's just you and me. No one's listening. Yes,
we're having an intimate, private moment.
Did you, are you the one? Please tell me yes. I want the answer to be yes.
What?
Because it makes me it'll make me very happy if the answer is yes. Are you the one that changed the Hollywood sign to say Holly Boob?
I wish I could say yes.
Shh, no, say yes.
I wish I could take credit
in
for
the
that.
Night, as I slept, you crept out on your little cat feet.
Uh-huh.
And you
climbed
scaled
all the way up to the
yes. I don't even know if what I'm saying is a real thing. I just saw it on Twitter.
You don't know if it's just somebody photoshopping
it? I don't know if this actually happened, but someone said it was happening on Twitter and they posted a photo and I thought, well, I hope it did. Because boob is a very funny word. Has always been a very funny word. And I like that someone, I want there to be a moment in Los Angeles right now where someone has the time, the energy, and the big idea-ness to go, hey, you know what that sign needs? It needs to say boob.
How can I change the meaning with only a couple of letters? I know.
It probably didn't happen. Someone's probably making up a story on Twitter. You know how many things on Twitter aren't real?
No, it's all real.
So many things
all
are not.
All true.
Anyway, I would like it. Just one. You know what? If we took a holiday.
Just some time to celebrate?
From not defacing the Hollywood sign in some way.
There was a great running gag on BoJack Horseman where in the first episode, the D of the Hollywood sign gets stolen.
Yeah.
And for the rest of the show, they refer to the city as Hollywood.
Hollywood.
And they're talking about like Hollywood celebrities.
I have never watched any BoJack Horseman.
You're in for a treat.
I know
that
I'm supposed to. I know that I should. I'm told that it's good for me.
It's not that you're supposed
to.
That
I will be very happy
if I do it. I think you'll like it a lot.
Yeah.
I have seen it described as one of the best shows about depression ever made.
Do I need that?
I
Is that something I need in this year of our Lord 2021?
Do we need anything in the entertainment realm? I don't know.
Why are we late with everything right now? Please explain yourself. There are two reasons, really.
The Sundance Film Festival is happening. My half of why we're late is Sundance. Started last Thursday.
Yes.
It is all taking place virtually. No one is in Utah that I know of, or at least not, you know, I think the local staff might be doing there. I don't know if they're having any actual screenings in actual venues at Sundance this year. It's all happening online. Very exciting. And, You know, which is great because I haven't covered Sundance in a few years because just the schlep is
right
a pain in the butt. But I can do this all from home. And I had this big idea when it all started. I told you, for the next like 5 days or so, just pretend I'm in Utah.
I've been trying.
Pretend I'm not here. I've tried. I'll just be doing my thing. And of course,
I have tried.
That really hasn't quite worked. But yeah, so pretty much every day I got movies to watch and reviews to write and other people's reviews to put through and yada, da, da. So that's put a crimp in our schedule. And my then your crimp.
My crimp. I just felt like I was getting sick on Friday. And I didn't know why or what. I was very just sort of run down.
Well, it might have had something to do with spending 3 hours on Thursday out in the cold.
But four.
4 hours.
4 hours on the balcony in the cold and yes. then the dark and then the rain. But that's a long story that has already been told on Linoleum Nights.
Yes.
It's a dumb story. It is a story that is about a minor inconvenience that I turned into...
Operatic.
The yes.
The Gotterdammerung.
So, I thought I was getting sick on Friday. I super hydrated, and I'll tell you guys, I have the greatest news. If you start to think you're feeling sick, just even the tiniest twinge of something, you know, like that little thing you feel like maybe like on one side of the back of your throat?
The faintest tickle.
You wonder what's going on and, oh no, is this something that's going to become something? Drink like a gallon of water, not all at once, but, you know, over the course of the day. Drink a lot of hot, like water with lemon, some...
Tea with honey.
Some decaf tea. Yeah. Then, about 30 minutes before you decide you're going to go to bed. And make sure you go to bed early.
Yeah.
Drink a cup of NyQuil. Not one measuring cup, but the little plastic cup.
Thank you for clearing that.
The little plastic cup that comes with the NyQuil.
Yes.
You're not sick yet. You just think you might get sick, maybe, and you're worried about that. But you do also know that sleep is the cure. Get a little plastic cup of NyQuil. Drink it. 13 hours later...
You begin opening your eyes again.
You begin opening your eyes again. And then what happens is the whole next day you spend in a NyQuil hangover haze. Mm. Then... 12 hours later, when it's early evening again, you take another cup of NyQuil.
This is, again, we have...
Do you know, I'm a medical doctor now, and I'm telling everyone the cure.
We don't have children, just to remind everybody of that.
I slept in the course of 36 hours, about 24 of those hours. I have never felt better in my life. I woke up yesterday morning... And it was like...
Electric youth.
Yeah, the clouds had parted. And whatever the twinge or threat of something was over.
Mm.
And I just was like, oh, man. So here's what I'm going to start doing. Once a month on a weekend when I just really need to catch up on sleep, I'm just going to drink NyQuil. It's not bad for you. It's good for you.
It's medicine.
It's medicine, and it makes you sleep for a wild ass amount of time.
All right, Judy.
This is my new health plan. I'm calling it wellness.
Neely took the green pills.
It's like when you go into the Aveda store in the mall, and they say, "Would you like some wellness?" That actually happened to me once.
I think you should at least, when you're not feeling cold symptoms, switch to the ZQL.
I guess.
It's just the sleeping
part. But I have such crappy allergies that the decongesting of the NyQuil is like an extra help.
Gotcha.
Yeah, one time I was in the Aveda store in the mall, and I was buying a little, like, you know, little lip balm for your Christmas stocking. Mm. You know, it was actually at Christmas time. And I buy the lip balm. It's like $5. And this gay behind the counter looks at me and says, "Would you like some wellness?" I was like, I don't know what this is.
What was the medium through which he was offering you the wellness?
A drink. It was this little drink that they had.
Huh.
And you had to pay for it.
Oh.
Yeah. And I was like, some what?
This was for a while.
And this was like 5 years ago. And people weren't using the word wellness day in, day out all the time. Gwyneth Paltrow had not come along and turned that word into a
It was a
juggernaut.
Concept. It wasn't a product.
Yeah.
I seem to recall the period where the Aveda store was always trying to push those little white gumballs on you for some reason.
I don't remember those.
I forget what that was even about.
But he kept saying the word wellness, and I kept looking at him like when a dog looks at you and cocks their head to the side. I was like, what's happening? What? Can you explain what is the wellness that you're going to give to me? And he's just a little drink, this little superfood thing that they... You know, the one with all the micronutrients.
Exactly.
And I refused
to
have
sure
it.
I'm sure this poor guy...
I just wanted him to keep saying wellness.
His manager got a memo from Regional, and they were like, you guys...
I was torn, too, because
really
I was like...
We really need to upsell on the wellness.
I was very torn, because I kept thinking, I see you, my fellow gay. You're at this store, you're working, trying to get through the day.
Mm.
They're pressuring you from above to sell the wellness drink.
Do you want wellness with that?
You are my queer sibling.
Mm.
I should support. We had that mutual.
Your retail endeavors.
We had that mutual homo understanding.
Did you?
The vibe, yes. Yes.
Because I never think gays know that you're a gay.
No, they do.
Okay.
They do.
All right.
They do. I look right at them.
You did walk into the Aveda store, which I guess is...
Well, there's your proof right there. It's like finding the Perrier bottle. Yeah. I'm a dude alone in the Aveda store. Yes.
Okay, fine.
Yes.
We're going to get mail now from straight guys who are like, what? Hey, I like the body leaf moisturizer.
Well, do you know what that means? That means you're secretly gay.
Stop. We don't own Aveda.
Shouldn't we?
We are owed it.
Do they exist anymore? I haven't been in a mall in 2 years.
I'm sure Aveda's around.
Not for lack of desire.
No.
There hasn't been. Everything's.
I miss malls.
Don't you want to go to the mall?
I so miss malls.
I really want to go to the mall.
Oh, man.
What's the pandemic?
Going through the whole.
Once we're all fully vaccinated.
Going through the Christmas season and
I
not being able
get
to go
a
to
hot
South
dog
Coast
on a
Plaza.
Stick at the mall. I want to go to the Sears. They don't have Sears anymore, I guess.
No. I want to hold up Lacoste shirts that will not fit me.
Oh, they will. The biggest one fits you at Lacoste.
Maybe. I used to. Who knows? Yeah, you've been cooking a lot.
I sure have. You're getting beef stroganoff for dinner tonight. Aren't you lucky?
I can't wait. Very excited.
I've had that Rice-A-Roni beef stroganoff song in my head all day. Remember that song on the commercial?
No.
The real beef stroganoff. Rice-A-Roni stroganoff.
No.
This guy with a really deep voice.
Oh, God. I got to look that up now.
Well, I've tried to find a commercial. I can't find it. It's lost.
So annoying.
Part of television history and it's gone.
Maybe the Paley has a copy.
They might. We should, yeah. Did we watch movies this week?
We did watch movies this week.
What did we watch?
Well, the big one is probably The Little Things.
Right. Now, here's the thing. All right. Here's what I want to do.
What?
Regarding The Little Things... A conversation needs to be had about a narrative element of that film, which is not a secret. It's about a serial killer who ritualistically murders and arranges his young female victims into these sort of like...
Tableau.
Yeah, like a True Detective kind of situation. Mm-hmm. Or Hannibal.
Yeah.
The way... Okay.
Without the artistry.
completely without it. But it's something I want to talk about in relationship to a letter that we got from a devoted listener, Shoddy, about the treatment of Elizabeth Debicki in Tenet.
Mm-hmm.
And about the ending of Promising Young Woman, which we did not talk about.
Right.
We did not speak about the ending when we talked about it last week. And I really want to, at the end of the show,
okay,
I want to have that conversation so that people who still haven't seen Promising Young Woman don't have to listen to that spoiler as we talk about the ending.
Okay.
We address the letter,
sure,
about Tenet, which we haven't yet when it comes to, you know, no one's written to us. Shoddy is the one person to write to us about Tenet. We saw it so late in the game. And watching The Little Things, which we can talk about right now, watching The Little Things with you, the more, as I watched it, I kept thinking, okay, yeah, True Detective, Hannibal, but also the idea of DeBicki's character in Tenet.
Uh-huh.
And the on-screen physical abuse that she suffers. And then the end of Promising Young Woman, which is also quite violent. So we'll talk about that all stuff as a lump,
okay,
near the end of the show, so you can stop listening if you don't want to hear it. And but right now, yes, let's talk about The Little Things. Why don't you explain what it is about?
Sure. Okay, so it is 1990, and we first meet Denzel Washington as a sheriff's deputy in Kern County, California. Kern County is where Bakersfield is. It's sort of north and, you know, landlocked. It's, you know, it's not by the ocean. It's very kind of agricultural, rural territory.
Yeah.
He is assigned to go to L.A. the following day to pick up some evidence for a trial that's going to be happening. He's not crazy about this assignment, but he goes. When he arrives, we discover that he used to be with the L.A. Sheriff's Department and was apparently a very big deal, kind of hotshot detective. But for reasons not immediately explained, left, went out to the country, you know, got a divorce, like big changes in his life. While he's there, he gets to know the sort of new up-and-comer in the department, played by Rami Malek, who is investigating a serial killer. Aspects of the case ring a bell to Denzel Washington and remind him of a case that he had worked on when he was in Los Angeles. So he winds up staying in town, helping out in an unofficial capacity, and is increasingly haunted by his actions in the past and how they color his judgment on this, on the current case, where they seem to have a suspect, a very, very red herring, played by Jared Leto.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's all you need to know.
Well, I think what else you need to know is that as the story progresses, it becomes less about the... It becomes less about finding the killer, although it does consistently stay about finding the killer.
Mm-hmm.
But finding the killer has to take, not a back seat, but it has to share the ride, I should say,
uh-huh,
with what becomes a muddled character study about not only Denzel Washington's character,
yes,
but Rami Malek's character, mm-hmm, and to a lesser extent, but still not insignificantly,
Jared Leto's
character. And by the end of the movie, when things turn out like you think they are going to turn out, but then maybe not exactly like you thought they would turn out, you wonder why you have watched it.
Yes, definitely.
Even though the getting there is still fairly entertaining.
Not even that, I don't
think. For me, because of the performances, not for any other real reason.
You know, Denzel Washington is fine, but he's not doing anything that we haven't seen him do before.
He's doing what he does.
I think Rami Malek is kind of terrible in this movie. Like, he's such a creeper for this guy who's supposed to be like an upright cop and a family man. I kept thinking, oh, is he the serial killer?
Well, yeah.
And
it's
like, no.
The film does want you to sometimes to think, what's his real deal? Because his wife will say things to him like, did you set the house alarm? They're about to go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll say, did you set the alarm? And he does this. Like, he's looking in the other direction, and then he looks at her in this very, like, weird Michael Myers in Halloween sort of way. And then he pauses for a moment and stares at her and he says, "Yes." And then he turns his head back in the other direction and walks off. And you're like, what was that about? What is he? Is he the killer? Like, you think this a lot through the film. It's directly meant to confuse you. You are meant to be confused by the motivations of the people in the film. You are meant to wonder, what did Denzel Washington's character do in the past that is haunting him?
Right.
What did he do that drove him away from Los Angeles out into Bakersfield?
Mm-hmm.
Other than a need to go to Buck Owens' Crystal Palace.
By the time it answers these questions, I didn't care anymore.
I kind of also didn't care anymore, but I was still having fun watching them act a lot.
Mm.
Denzel Washington can stroll through a movie like this and lend a sort of importance to it, even though there might not be anything important at all.
Sure, yeah.
He has this ability as an actor to just look at the camera and make you think, oh, something serious is about to happen, or this is something serious that Denzel Washington is about to, you know, communicate to me.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, like, the movie doesn't deserve his gravitas because right. It's not giving him anything. He's doing all the work to give it some kind of heft
right.
that it never really has otherwise.
And you're right. Rami Malek's every move is idiosyncratic and mysterious in a way that keeps you guessing until it doesn't anymore.
Right. Well,
until you realize, I don't know, he's determined. His twitchiness is all about his need to fix this situation.
Yeah.
Like, he's got a savior sort of complex.
Mm-hmm.
The film does a very bad job of communicating that, but I've been thinking about this for a week now since we watched it. All of the religious references in the film,
mm-hmm.
which are meant to add up to
something,
but we don't know what. I think what it's really meant to do is add up to the idea that Rami Malek wants to be a god in this situation. And in his need to be a god in this situation butts up against Jared Leto's need to do the same thing, but in a wicked way.
To be the devil.
Jared Leto wants to be the devil. Whether or not he's actually the murderer.
Right. That is a generous read, and I guess I can see...
I'm figuring that's where the movie was trying to go.
Yeah, I can see the scaffolding that you're building for this, but I don't buy it. This is written and directed by John Lee Hancock, who is... I really like The Rookie, but I think most of his other stuff is sort of negligible. You know, he did The Founder and The Alamo and
right.
Saving Mr. Banks
right.
and... The Blind Side.
You know what part of Saving Mr. Banks I really like?
Cranky Emma Thompson.
The Let's Go Fly a Kite sequence. When they are, like, it's complete. You know it didn't happen.
But and they're, like, playing her the song.
They're playing her the song, and suddenly they're all dancing and everything. You're like, oh, this song is so great, you know?
So what you like about Saving Mr. Banks is a thing from Mary Poppins.
Right.
Okay.
The Feed the Birds song. It was another great song from Mary Poppins.
So, yeah, I think, again, like, not only is it sort of thematically similar to True Detective, but it also feels like, what if you had to put an entire season of True Detective in a 2-hour sausage casing?
Yeah.
Because I think there's so much that's connective tissue here that's missing, and it either should have been, like, shorter or longer, because either...
It should have been a series.
Either cut to the chase or, like, actually expand on...
An actual season of True Detective.
Yeah.
Starring big movie stars.
Exactly.
You know,
which it always does. Or expand on the ideas that you're sort of introducing here and then not following through on hardly any of them.
Right. But I'm not quite done.
Okay.
Jared Leto, you know, he has decided at this point in his career... Now that he has an Academy Award, and I think he thinks that is important.
I'm sure he does.
He has decided to be the methodiest of the Method Men.
Well, he's...
And, yes. No, but, and to that end, he is creepy and gross.
Which he spent a lot of his screen career being. I think he's one of those people who, like, when he started out, it was all like, wow, you're so cute. And he was like, but no, I am a serious actor. Right. So please let me put this mud on my face so that you will take me seriously.
Right. You know, the movie does not hold together at all. But watching these three people gave me occasional pleasure. What I don't like is the stuff that we're going to talk about at the end. The women as death props.
Sure.
Is really, I
have another thing I don't like about this movie that I'm also going to talk about at the end.
Okay.
So let's put a pin there.
But here's what I do like. Mm-hmm. Not just the performances, but I like that it's about ugly Los Angeles.
Oh, for sure. They do find a lot of corners you don't usually see in movies about LA.
Right. I like that it's about cops who are completely terrible at their jobs. And I like that it's about, you know, greasy murderers who might not even be murderers. They might just be greasy creepos.
Right. I wish this movie had played a little bit with the 1990 of it all.
Well, like, there doesn't even seem to be,
you know, yes,
a reason.
They don't have cell phones, they don't have the internet.
Yeah, like that seems to be the only reason why it's set in 1990. They lift not one small tiny pinky finger to make you think that it's supposed to look like 1990, which, by the way, was still the 80s.
Yeah, like apparently he wrote the script in 93 and all just right. didn't want to retool it because he would have had to like overhaul the whole thing.
Yes.
But yeah, like, and it's not like one of those movies where, you know, not every period piece has to give you some like somebody who looks like they would be on MTV that year showing you what the kids were all up to or whatever.
Right.
I get it. Cops always wear sort of boxy suits and drive boxy cars. But like you could throw in a little 1990s zazz in there, you know, just for a sense of time and place.
There should have been more than a Bonfire of the Vanities billboard.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's all we get.
Yeah.
There is not a moment that makes you like I had to keep reminding myself that it's set in 1990. Give me a lapel.
Yeah.
That fits the era.
A Batman
t-shirt.
A haircut.
A what now?
A Batman t-shirt.
Something. Something. One thing. It'll make it. No, they gave us one thing. Two things. All right. That's the not great one. The other two are good.
Yeah.
What happened was.
Yeah, there are three.
And Saint. Oh, yeah, that's right. And Saint Maud.
Mm-hmm.
And the White
Tiger.
The White Tiger. I keep forgetting the title. I guess if I watch it, I'll remember the title.
That'll probably
you've
help.
Seen it. I have not
it's
yet.
It's also
seen
the
it.
Third Netflix thing this year, at least, to have Tiger in the title. There was Tiger Tale, which I really loved, about the Taiwanese immigrants.
That was good.
There was Tiger King, which. And now White Tiger. So.
Am I the only person that didn't watch Tiger King?
Maybe.
I found it was at the beginning of the pandemic,
yeah.
And I was so upset about everything constantly that I thought, why do I want to sit down and watch a show that's going to upset me more about people being hideous?
Yeah.
You know?
It was...
So I didn't.
We were all glued to it, and then we all regretted it somehow. What happened was?
What happened was, from writer-director Tom Noonan.
Yes.
1994. The very, very tall... Tom Noonan. It is the story of two people, a man, a woman, in New York City. The man is played by Tom Noonan. The woman is played by...
Karen Silas.
Thank you for that name. They are co-workers. They are going to have dinner together at her apartment. This is a first date.
Yes.
Sort of. And the action takes place entirely in her apartment.
Yes.
It begins awkwardly, this date. Moves into a quality that can best be described as strained, yet also vaguely horny.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes incredibly upsetting and disturbing and sad. And then it's over. It is a feel bad experience, and yet it is a good film.
I think it's a really terrific film.
You know? How do I describe? The entire film is just them in the apartment talking.
Yes.
And it takes this turn when they're finished with dinner and they're on the couch and things are either going to get like
physical,
kissy smoochy, or they're not, or we're going to have souls bared.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is the soul bearing. Mm. Although I don't think either one of these characters understands just how deeply their soul is being bared.
Yeah, they're telling more than they realize they're telling,
yeah.
And they're doing it in an indirect way, but to anyone paying attention to what they're actually saying, it's like, oh, you're telling me that.
Both of them, if you were on a date with either one of these people, you would think to yourself,
run,
I have to go. I have to leave now. How fast can I leave? If he came to my apartment on a date, I'd say, you know, I know it's only 9. But I promised a friend I would take them to the airport at 6 a.m. And if I were in the apartment on the date, I would say, you know, I know it's only 9, but I have to leave because I promised I would take this friend to the airport at 6 a.m.
See, that's an L.A. excuse, but a shaky one, but not a New York excuse because nobody takes anybody to the airport in New York.
What if it's New Jersey? What if they have to take them to the, you know, that
Newark?
One? Newark, yeah.
No, nobody, well, first of all, nobody drives in
I
New York.
I guess.
And anyway. Unlike here, they're trained actually to go to the airport.
Any excuse you could come up with to get the heck yourself, out, yes. Remove yourself from the situation. It's not like anyone is in danger in the film.
No.
Although there is a moment that looks like a horror movie where a knife is brought out and you wonder what the intention of the
filmmaker.
Yeah.
There's also a scene involving old dolls.
Yeah, old dolls. You know, both of them are sort of fooling themselves about who they are,
mm-hmm.
in relationship to not only each other, but to their workplace, to their place in the city.
Their cultural ambitions.
Yeah. And so by the time it's over, the deeper the story goes and the more unsettling and disturbing and the more deep the sadness becomes, you realize they're not ready for dating each other. They're not ready for life.
Yeah.
Their damage is slowly revealed in ways that made me, as a viewer, I had never seen this before,
mm-hmm.
Increasingly upset. And yet hooked into following it through to the end.
Yeah, I saw it in 1994 when it came out. It won 2 prizes at Sundance that year.
Okay.
Did not get a great release from Samuel Goldwyn. I read this interview with Tom Noonan where he was like, you know, they also had Oleana and that's where they were putting all of their like money,
right.
and efforts.
Right.
But I remember going to a press screening here in Los Angeles in a fairly small screening room. And, you know, it was mostly critics who knew each other and before the screening were very chatty and blah, blah, blah. After the movie ended, pin drop.
Right.
Like, no one spoke to each other. No one looked at each other. We all just sort of filed out to our cars like, and I just remember the impact that film having on us all. And then it
well,
kind
did you
of,
talk to anyone?
Immediately afterwards, no. I mean, later,
I
yes. But, you know... the movie kind of went away. Like, you know, it was released on VHS. I don't know that it was ever on like even DVD, much less Blu-ray.
Yeah.
So I'm thrilled that Oscilloscope is doing this 4K restoration and reissuing it now, because I think a lot of people don't know even that it existed. And Tom Noonan had this moment where he like wrote and directed a couple of movies, and I think they were both really good. He followed this with a film called The Wife a couple years later.
All right.
And, this film apparently was a huge influence to Charlie Kaufman, who saw it when he was writing Being John Malkovich.
Okay.
And then later would turn around and cast Noonan in Synecdoche, New York and Anomalisa.
You know, it makes sense that it would influence Charlie Kaufman because I think of Charlie Kaufman's films as being very much like, and this is a conversation I was having recently with our friend Elizabeth, much like Chai Ming Lang, his films are about loneliness.
Yeah.
And this film is about loneliness. But loneliness to the point where you are maybe irreparably damaged.
You can imagine the awkwardness between these two as being not that far afield as some of the awkwardness that transpires between Jesse Buckley and Jesse Plemons in I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Yeah. There's a in Chai Ming Lang, there's a sorrow and a longing and an ache that you feel throughout the course of his many films. I don't feel that here. I feel just a sort of a deadening quality, which makes it, again, more upsetting, really.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it probably, it's the kind of thing years from now we can sort of tie into this sort of moment in history where, like, you know, there's less sort of civic outreach and there's less family connection and there's less like church related, you know, for a lot of people.
Right.
Like that, we've had this conversation before about the whole thing about the Bowling for One or Bowling Alone book, whatever that came out.
Okay.
This idea that more people than ever bowl in the United States, but there are fewer bowling leagues and teams than ever before.
Oh.
And so it used to be that...
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. And so like it's this thing where when we look at the way American life has changed over the last few decades, people used to belong to clubs. People used to belong to organizations and, you know, groups and did stuff. And you see less and less in that, more and more that people are just sort of isolated. They're on the internet. They're at home watching television. You know, maybe they don't deal with their families anymore for whatever reason. And so, you know, there's this kind of fracture that goes on where people are just, you know, white knuckling it with no support systems. They are literally alone. And these films, I think, capture that sensation of a society where people don't feel like they're part of something that's there for them.
I think that when we're all vaccinated, that I should start a baking club. And friends, people would come over and bake things and bring the things they baked. Everyone baked something at their house and then come over here and we all enjoy it and eat it and talk about baking.
I
this is a very good idea that I just had on the mic.
I like it. I have to say, I have thought more and more about the idea of a post-vaccine world in which I want to belong to some kind of something, you know. I don't know how to quilt, you know, but I mean, like, some kind of...
What will you take up and learn? Or rather, what do you already know how to do that you would like to organize a group of people around and leave the apartment?
Oh, happily.
So that I can have time to myself. Because I'm perfectly happy to just stay here.
Don't threaten me with a good time, believe me. I've been a homebody my whole life, but I think I'm going to go through about a four-month period where, like, I'm never here. That'll be my roaring 20s.
It's Tuesday night, and you run off to, like, go-go dancer night at Akbar, you know?
Well,
like,
maybe not that.
I'll see you at 2 a.m., baby.
More likely, I'll go to belly dancing lessons somewhere, you know?
You got that belly.
I do.
It's time
Shame
you
to put it to
it's
waste.
It's time you learn how to shake it.
No, I'm not going to take belly dancing, but, you know, but like some sort of, like, lessons or a club or something. You watch old movies and you realize that people used to...
My bowling league.
But yes.
Why don't you join a bowling league?
You know, the...
Do you like to bowl?
I'm not very good at it.
Neither am I, but wouldn't you like to be...
My Kiwanis meeting, you know.
You could become a Rotarian.
I was in the Interact Club in high school.
I don't know what that is.
That was like the teen Rotarian...
But what did they do? What? I don't even know what a Rotarian is. I just threw that word out.
They have luncheons and they do a lot of networking and then they do like charitable stuff. They all do. These guys all do. You know, I think it was mainly just an excuse to, like, you know, have like
shoot pool somewhere,
boozy lunches, and hang out with the fellas, and then they do like a fundraiser for the children's hospital or whatever.
Right.
You know.
So anyway, this movie, what happened was, it is a drama about city life that never shows you the city except through glass windows of this one apartment. People are sort of stuck in this one room. So
it's very of the now.
Perfect time to restore it and re-release it, because that's what's happening. Now, again, the feel-bad movie of 1994 is now the feel-bad movie of 2021. So
don't miss it.
Give it a shot. Speaking of feel-bad, we watched the... A horror film.
Yes.
Saint Maud.
Now, it's an A24 horror film.
It is a psychological horror film. Let's call it what it is. It's a psychological horror film. It's not about, you know, a murderer chasing teens through, you know, space like Jason X.
They can't all be Jason X, Dave.
I know. But more films should aspire.
It did set a standard.
To being Jason X. This is directed by Rose Glass. Her first, she co-wrote it and directed, or maybe she wrote it entirely. I can't remember now. She at least co-wrote it and directed it. It's her first full-length feature. She's done some
wrote
shorts.
And directed.
She wrote and directed. Okay. It stars Morfydd Clark. That is a cool name.
Yes.
That I spent many moments trying to pronounce.
She's Welsh.
She's Welsh, so that's a name from Wales. Morfydd. Her name is Morfydd Clark, and Jennifer Ely. And it is about a young nurse whose new job is tending to a dying woman. The young nurse is Morfydd Clark, and the dying woman is Jennifer Ely. She is a famous choreographer, and their relationship over the time they spend together becomes obsessive in increasingly horrifying ways, primarily because Morfydd Clark's character, Maud, is really named Katie. And she has a past. And
yes,
we don't know what happened in that past.
She would like to not talk about.
She would like to never speak of it. She occasionally runs into nurses that she used to work with who sometimes bring up the past and say, oh, you know, no one blames you for that thing that happened.
When they're not saying, oh, you're
still a
nurse?
Yeah. So, meanwhile, Maud has undergone a religious conversion to a brand of Christianity that is all the worst parts of Catholicism and fundamentalist evangelical Christianity.
Rolled into one.
All rolled into one. But it does include, you know, that very wobbly, mystical kind of faith that is mostly mania.
Yeah.
And the kind that makes the historical saints legendary, visions, experiences of the supernatural, the kind of things that alienate you to the population around you.
Right.
As her relationship with Jennifer Ely progresses, Jennifer Ely starts calling her, oh, my little savior. It's very condescending, paternalist, because, you know, she's an artist, and she has cool art friends, and they're very sophisticated, and they come to the house, and they, you know, have parties with their friend who they know is about to die. And this upsets Maud, because Maud wants the dying woman to herself.
Right. Well, and she literally does want to be her savior.
She does, in fact, yes, want to be the savior. So, pretty much, this is like if Diary of a Country Priest was Repulsion.
Oh.
And
that's a really good description.
It's mysterious in that you think one thing might be happening, but then you realize it's something much more down to earth and heartbreaking.
Mm.
And it is, and I'm not going to tell you anything that happens, but it is horror in the best way for me, in that it makes you feel very bad. I'm of the opinion that a horror film should be horrifying and leave you feeling horrible. I don't really care for the ones where they get the killer at the end and everyone's all happy and, you know, all smiles. I mean, there's been a slaughter, right? But you get to take a breath. You get to take a breather. Order has been restored,
mm-hmm.
and you get to leave the theater.
Yeah, you mentioned
I like a horror movie where the bad thing keeps happening.
You know, you mentioned Repulsion, and that and Rosemary's Baby both are movies where, like, yeah, the lights come up and you're like, there's no catharsis. There's a, like, I'm still in this.
And I love the filmmaking here. It's directed.
Oh, yeah.
It's this very intense, intimate focus.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps you guessing. It absolutely keeps you guessing where it's going because you don't really know if maybe she is a saint.
She is.
Maybe she's not completely broken. We don't know.
She's an unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
And so much of the film is sort of perceived through her eyes. There's not much literal narration going on, but you still have to like take the word for is what you're seeing what you're seeing, or is what you're seeing what Maud sees.
So I really dig this. Now I'm interested in this rose glass person.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to know what she'll do next.
For sure.
Chances are it's going to be more horror because her short films were all horror based shorts, although I haven't seen any of them. So anyway, yeah, Saint Maud, it's streaming. Virtual cinemas, I guess that's where you'll also find What Happened Was.
Yes, correct.
And I guess A Little Things is sort of an iTunes
No. It's situation. HBO Max.
Oh, HBO Max. So they're proud.
Well, for like...
HBO Max proudly presents.
For like 30 days, and it's also in theaters.
Got
and,
it. You know.
So The White Tiger is on Netflix. It's the new film from Ramin Barani, a filmmaker I think is really cool.
Yes.
And who is always interested in sort of economic issues and issues of, you know, poverty and whatnot that I think he handles in a really sensitive way.
Yeah.
This is based on the Man Booker Prize winning novel by, pardon me if I'm getting this name wrong, Arvind Adiga. And it is set in India, and we open with a guy named Balram, played by Adarsh Gaurav, who's up for a Spirit Award for this performance. He's great. He's one of his like very first films, and he's like in the whole thing.
Yes.
He has sort of risen to a level of entrepreneurial success and is kind of telling his story as to how he got there. And he basically came from a family that was dirt poor, figured out the only way to sort of get anywhere in the world was to get a job as a driver for the son of the landlord that kind of like owned the whole town that he lived in.
Right.
And so he manages to finagle his way into that position. So he is working for Ashok, played by Rajkumar Rao, and his wife, Pinky Madam, played by Priyanka Chopra Jonas. And, Pinky Madam is from Queens, and Ashok has studied in the West, and they seem to be more progressive than, like, Ashok's father, who's very traditional and, like, treats... our hero Balram just like total crap.
You have employees, you can also beat them.
Yeah, yeah. Essentially.
Yeah.
But then as we come to discover when Ashok and Pinky Madam get themselves into some trouble, they are also perfectly happy to send Balram into, you know, like to treat him like dirt and make him take the fall for everything. And so then we sort of, you know, kind of follow on this sort of Candide-esque journey as to how he is able to achieve success. And it is I've already heard people comparing it to Parasite, you know, which I think, again, it's not because this movie got made because of Parasite.
No.
Both these movies exist because of the way the world is right now.
Right.
And, you know, if we can't. If we can't make rich people see the logic in, you know, doing something about economic disparity, then let's scare them.
I agree.
Yeah, but this is a really extraordinary movie. I mean, it is very darkly satirical. It shows you an India that is like wealthy and modern and, you know, like prepared to take on the challenges of sort of post superpower global economics, and also shows you like just the crushing poverty, you know, and it's all germane to the story. Barani is Iranian, but he has been friends with Arvind Adiga for so long that the novel was actually dedicated to him, among others. So this is kind of like full circle that he's now making the movie of it. I think it's just it's I think you would like it a lot because it's
dark. Sure, I'm sure I will. I like I have seen Man Push Cart, and I think that's really great.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've seen
99
other
Homes.
Well, I've seen the later stuff like 99 Homes, but that's not so great.
99 Homes, if you lopped off the last 3 minutes, I think would be really
okay. Sure. But yeah, no, I'm it's on my list of, it's on my to-do list.
Okay.
To see list.
Cool.
Definitely. You have a DVD pick of the week, pick of the week.
You do
some
yours,
kind of pick of the week.
You do yours first. Mine's a good follow-up.
Well, yeah, Cicely Tyson died.
Yes.
Like 2 days after Clovis Leachman or something like that. They were both 95, 96.
In that area, yeah.
Yeah. And I've been thinking about her and just thinking about, it's been a very long time since I have seen this film, but her death makes me want to rewatch it. And the reason her death makes me want to rewatch it is because I remember what an impact it had on me as a child. You know, when I was a little kid, I couldn't wait to get away from having to watch the little kid movies at the Saturday afternoon matinees. I lived for any mainstream release that came to our town that also managed to get a matinee situation going on the weekends.
Whether it was G or PG, right?
Whether it was G or PG. And a lot of wide release films at that time were still rated G if they were for, you know, everyone. They weren't. G was not a children's film designation entirely at
What's
that time.
What's Up, Doc was rated G.
In the 1970s, yeah. Well, in 1972, I was 8 years old. And very grown up.
Oh, yes.
So I was ready for serious dramas, anything you could throw at me. I'm an adult now, and I can watch these films. Sounder came along, and it happened to be rated G. And it is from Martin Ritt. He directed it. He directed Hud. He directed Norma Rae, Cross Creek, Stanley and Iris. Remember that?
Yep.
The wacky Barbara Streisand movie Nuts.
Oh, God, yes. He directed that, didn't he?
But he directed Sounder. And it is a story of a sharecropping family in Louisiana in the 1930s. Cicely Tyson and Paul Winfield are the parents. And their young son, Kevin Hooks, wants to get an education and learn to write. He wants to write. A series of terrible events befall the family. The father is sent off to prison. And the reason it's called Sounder is the dog is named Sounder.
Yeah.
Well, there's a moment in this movie that has stayed with me my entire life.
I think I know which one you mean.
When Paul Winfield comes home.
Yes.
And Cicely Tyson sees him in the dirt road coming up. She lets out this cry and runs to him. And there's this, she's acting with her entire body.
Yes.
And I've never, up again, I was eight. So, you know, I hadn't seen a lot of greatness in cinema yet. But this is one of those moments.
Absolutely.
I've never forgotten it because real emotion, extremely powerful emotion like that, that she delivers in that scene is something you don't get very often because it felt real and it didn't feel like showy acting. Mm-hmm. It felt like something from inside her.
Yeah.
And it was it's scorched into my memory. And I remember going home and I think, I don't know if my parents ever asked me anything about, you know, what I saw. Like, I don't think they cared very much. They're just like, oh, does he want to go to the movies? Great. 3 hours. He's gone. At least he's not home nonstop talking to us. As much as I wanted to be left alone as a child, I was not a quiet child. I was a talky kid. I was a talking child.
See, that's why you're a podcaster.
And so,
you can talk and talk and talk, and you can still don't have to be around anyone else but me.
Anyway, I remember coming home from Sounder and saying, That's the best movie I've ever seen in my life.
Mm.
It's still one of the great ones.
Yeah.
I know it was nominated for Academy Awards. I don't think it won anything.
No, I think she was nominated as well.
And she was nominated, yeah. But man, what a great movie it is. And I know TCM just showed it.
Yes.
Did we get it in the new improved TiVo?
I did not, but it'll be in the TCM app.
Okay. Yeah. Because I'd like to... I'm recommending it to y'all if you've never... I mean, you maybe have heard of it. I mean, yeah. It was very much of its moment in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. And then people kind of stopped talking about it.
Yeah.
But it's a great film.
Absolutely.
With an all-timer performance from Cicely Tyson.
So my DVD pick this week is also a Cicely Tyson movie, but one that I haven't seen. Well, here's the thing. She died 2 days after the publication of her memoir.
Yeah.
Which is, like I said on Twitter, the character in Breathless, who says that his goal in life is to become immortal and then die.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was a weird coincidence. But this week, we have the release of a film called A Man Called Adam.
Okay.
On Blu-ray. It's one of two new Blu-rays of two vintage Sammy Davis Jr. films.
Yes.
That Kino Lorber is putting out. Mm-hmm. And this film, this cast is extraordinary. Sammy Davis Jr., Cicely Tyson, Louis Armstrong, Ossie Davis, Mel Torme, set in the world of jazz, shot in black and white, directed by Sean Penn's dad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Leo Penn. So, you know, it just...
The film debut of Lola Falana as well.
Ooh, okay.
Now, I have also never seen this. I know it exists. I've always known it was...
Yeah, you always see it on, like, lists of movies about jazz or whatever. Right. But yeah, I've never seen it, but now I'm gonna.
I am too.
Man. We have a letter.
Do we have a letter?
Yes.
Okay. I'll pull that up right now in my inbox of letters.
And before we get to letters, just a quick mention. We just hit 5 years on our Patreon account.
Congratulations, us.
Woo, we did it.
Yeah.
You want to tell people about?
Yeah, sure. We have a Patreon. You can subscribe to it. It's just varying amounts of money. You get things.
Varying amounts of things.
There's content across the board. You get daily recommendations that we call LKRX. You get Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, which is when we take an old movie and we talk about it for 20, 30, 40 minutes. You get LKTV, a podcast about television. You get Linoleum Knife and Fork, a podcast about food. You get Linoleum Nights, a podcast about whatever.
Mm.
Sometimes we just sit down on a Sunday morning and have a rambling conversation for an hour. Sometimes we have a topic. And that's what you get. Go to patreon.com/linoleumknife. Maybe you'll like that.
Do it.
All right, here's the letter
okay. From
Cody. My film tastes over the last year have changed dramatically, and I can assure you that my hot love affair with Ovid has started strong. Are you listening to
Ooh.
That, Ovid?
Looky there.
Look what we did for you, Ovid.
You're welcome.
However, instead of setting a list of my favorite 2020 movies, I figured I would send you a list of my favorite movies that I watched for the first time in 2020.
Okay.
So, Three Faces from Jafar Panahi.
Oh, so good.
Such a good film. A Man There Was. Now, this is a 1917 Swedish silent film.
Don't know it.
From Victor Sjostrom.
Sjostrom.
I've never seen this film. But he says, this is a film I cannot get out of my head. Well, now I want to watch it.
Hmm. I've heard of the filmmaker, but I do not know that movie.
Bobby Jean. Another one I haven't seen from 2017, from Elvira Lind. He says it's one of the best documentaries to illustrate the experimental art of dance.
Huh.
Fisherman's Friends, 2019, from Chris Foggen.
Didn't see it, heard good things.
Asako 1 and 2.
Oh, okay.
Which has been on our list for a long time.
Yes.
Catherine Briot's Fat Girl. He says, I was not prepared for the ending. Well, no one is.
That's kind of the point.
No one is prepared for the ending of Fat Girl. 2012's The Act of Killing from Joshua Oppenheimer. Lagan, Once Upon a Time in India. Sports. You know what? No, Lagan is actually a really cool movie.
Yeah.
I remember having to review that back in the day for iFilm.
Yes.
And I remember going to the screening and thinking, I'm sorry, this is 4 hours long? What's happening?
And it's
here?
About cricket?
And then had a really great time. Mm. Section 375 from 2019, Ajay Bal. He says, I think this is the only film I know where the Me Too movement is addressed in the plot of the film.
Hmm.
Okay, I haven't seen it. And Soul Station from 2016 from Yun Sang Ho, a great animated prequel to Train to Busan. Hmm. Well, Cody, you've seen about five films here that we have not.
Yes.
So we're giving you the total benefit of the doubt.
Yes.
That they're amazing. Your list is 100% knife.
Yes.
Congratulations. We have catching up to do on the titles that you have just recommended
exactly.
to us.
I'm not the biggest fan of The Art of Killing, but I get that most people like it way more than I do, so I'll let you have it.
Well then, yes, you must give that to him. Is that it? Are we done? What's going on?
Well, I just wanted to send you the one letter because then we were going to have the
post. Oh, yes, that's right. The conversation.
The All things.
Right. You guys, turn off the podcast if you don't want to know how Promising Young Woman ends.
You know what? Let me do my spiel.
All right.
And then you can turn it off.
All right.
But hey, check out our friends on the internet. Go. Well, first of all, listen to my other shows, please. Breakfast All Day, Who Shot You on the Maximum Fun Network, A Film and a Movie, and... Hallmark
ones.
On the Bramble Jam podcast network. Listen to Bibbs and Whitney and what they're up to over the critically acclaimed podcast. Check out Schmoes Know. Dennis, anyone with Dennis Hensley, the comics canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, Big Fat Gay Podcast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. And if you leave us a 5-star review, we will happily read that on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, Amazon Music, CastBox, Podbean. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. He's on Twitter at Blutopia, BLEUTOPIA. And now we're going to spoil Promising Young Woman and maybe Tenet and also The Little Thing. So turn it off now if you don't want to hear any of that.
Right. If you don't want to hear this, then accept this as your goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
If you want to keep going, we're going to talk about these things. They've all been in my head.
Okay.
All swirled up. And I've been trying to sort of differentiate between them.
Uh-huh.
Promising Young Woman, Carey Mulligan's character, dies.
Yes.
At the end of the film. And she dies as what appears to be a sort of act of self-sacrifice.
Yes. She pre-arranges for, you know, if I don't come back, these letters will tell you where I went and who I saw and what happened.
She walks into a bachelor party that is happening at the end of the film, knowing that she could be killed.
Right.
Because she's going to confront the guy who raped her friend.
Yes.
And when she does, he kills her.
Well, he's very apologetic when she handcuffs him.
Right.
But then as soon as he gains the upper hand, he and his friend very quickly...
He snaps out of the handcuffs because of those cheap little novelty, you know, sex shop handcuffs. And, you know, they got like fluffy
fur
on the outside. And that couldn't have been a mistake on her part, right? Like... She is so methodical and so meticulously planned in all other areas of her, you know, mission of vengeance throughout this film that it makes you feel as though this character walks into the scenario wanting to die. So when she does, I wasn't completely surprised by the ending. I know a lot of people are feeling a little shocked by the ending, but over the course of the film, you know, I... realized that as we had discussed earlier, the level of confrontation, the nature of the confrontations that she encounters throughout the film are not just sort of realistically implausible, but they are increasingly symbolic. with the exception of the one that she has with Molly Shannon, who plays the mother of her friend. Mm-hmm. Every other encounter she has in the film feels like a symbolic, act of retribution. And so that you feel like, you know, what's going to happen here at the end is she has no choice but to become martyred. And I think that the point of the film is that by taking it all the way, you run the risk of having your life, if not literally destroyed, sort of perhaps, metaphorically destroyed. And so I feel like this ending is within, it's in keeping with the rest of the film and where the film is going. And because it's been, written and directed by a woman, mm-hmm. I think that's the point she's making, that there might not be a hopeful way forward in these kinds of scenarios. And that's a very pessimistic, tone, but I get it. And so
there's certainly a broader history in film and literature, the notion of the person who seeks revenge should dig two graves.
Right.
The very nature of this quest will destroy you.
Right.
Making it specifically about this kind of righteous vengeance being equally as damaging is, I think, a bolder stance, but that's obviously where she wanted to go with it.
Right. So even though an act of violence befalls Carey Mulligan's character in the film, it feels as though the filmmaker has decided to make this happen to follow through with the terrible trajectory of what was what the film was building on. Mm-hmm. Not so with The Little Things and with Tenet. Mm-hmm. Shoddy sent me a letter, and the letter was saying, can we please talk about the way that the one main female character in this film is horrific? In what?
In Tenet. Just, you mentioned two movies.
In Tenet, the one, main female character in this film is brutalized. She is punched. She is kicked. She is stomped on and then shot.
Yes.
Okay. So, why? This could have gone on off screen. You could have suggested that Kenneth Branagh's character is physically abusive toward her, making him still a villain and a particularly disgusting kind of villain, because not only is he, trying to destroy the world,
right,
but he's going to take out his own wife in the process as a daily routine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I thought about that. I thought about the letter. And I thought, this is true. This is what happens in the film. And there doesn't seem to be a good reason for it, other than to show you that he's a very bad man.
Well, this kind of ties into the whole fridging discussion, which is let's do horrible, horrible things to a woman because the male lead needs a motivation or because, but it has nothing to do with her character. And it certainly has nothing to do with it's extraneous and gratuitous and gross.
Right. Now, and we touched on this when we talked about Tenet, but when I saw The Little Things, I thought, oh, this again.
Yeah.
There are two main women in The Little Things. There's the coroner and
the partner
and the detective.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's also Rami Malek's wife and Denzel's ex-wife, but they come and go very quickly.
The point is that the other women in the film are corpses.
Mm-hmm.
Artfully arranged corpses.
Haunting corpses.
For seemingly, again, no reason but to be decorative in a gruesome way.
If I think there is a weird excuse of like, well, if she's on a coroner's slab, then she gets to be topless.
Right.
And that would be that would be organic, right?
Yeah.
You know, it gives me the creeps.
I want to know the answer to this, right? I understand, and I'll be the first person to say, depiction is not endorsement.
Sure.
But we have a depiction problem.
Well, yeah.
We have an incredibly lopsided cinema historical depiction problem.
It's an imbalance for sure.
And I say we as though I'm somehow part of the filmmaking industry. I am not. But I think part of my job is to say, hey, you have a depiction problem.
Indeed.
And the history of cinema is one in which women are routinely brutalized on camera.
For entertainment purposes.
For the purposes of entertainment. Sometimes it's relevant to the story. Sometimes the filmmaker's motivations have a lot to do with it, and they can explain why it's in the film.
Yeah, they're defensible.
But y'all know good and well that a lot of times it just isn't that way.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I'm saying is, and what Shadi sort of like put into focus for me with her letter was, big studio movies like this that are meant for everyone to see. What are y'all doing? I mean, we all know it's this ugly normality.
Right. But ugly normalities can change, you know.
They can.
We look back at like 80s movies and the sort of like gay jokes and casual racism and things that you look at now and are just sort of appalling. Like, we should be appalled by this, and I think we'll be appalled by it later, and maybe let's stop making them appalling now.
We just watched Bonnie and Clyde the other night.
Mm-hmm.
For the LK Club meeting, which is something you get with Patreon.
Yes.
And the level of violence in that film is, first of all, it's completely operatic. And secondly, it's
shocking.
To this day, 1968?
Seven.
It is blunt violence that you watch it even now and you're like, oh, whoa, whoa. And the ending in particular. And you see Faye Dunaway's character be machine gunned into
oblivion.
Yeah. And Warren Beatty as well.
Side by side.
And the artistic merits of that, I think, personally, are unassailable. Mm-hmm. But there are people who are not very thoughtful out there. And the door opened. Mm-hmm. Right? The door opened in a way that allowed for every big studio movie to contain like wild levels of violence. We have in the 70s also, it became a wild level of sexual expression as well. And we've dialed back from that quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see a lot of heavy duty sex scenes in mainstream Hollywood films anymore. Mainstream studio films anymore. That's the world of indie cinema.
Yeah.
But you keep seeing, you know, insane violence. I'm not talking about the horror genre, in which insane violence is
the norm.
One of the ticket buying impulses that you have, right? And I think genre films like that have their own reason to exist. That's why the book Men, Women, and Chainsaws was written. But the casualness of what you see in Tenet, the casualness of what you see in The Little Things is stupid and ugly, and I would like it to stop.
Well, you know, I think when you talk about opening the door, that's really the thing. It's like Bonnie and Clyde, The Wild Bunch, these are movies that knew what they were doing, and they were using violence in a very specific way, and they were portraying violence in a very specific way.
Yes.
And then, you know, some sleazebag exploitation producer goes, oh, we can get away with that now? Well, let's just do that. you know, for whatever. It's sort of like how Halloween spawned a lot of really terrible movies,
right?
You know, and not even like, oh, I'm you know, morally offended by them. They're just crappy movies, you know. But it, so it intent is so key to what makes this stuff work.
One of the things that Shoddy says in her letter is, you know, everyone is so wrapped up trying to figure out what Tenet is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which, they, you know, yeah.
Good luck.
That very few people are talking about this thing.
Yeah.
You know, this one character who is literally the one woman in the movie.
Yeah.
Who is not like the big boss. And I forget the actress's name.
Oh, the arms dealer?
That plays the arms dealer.
Yeah.
But, you know, the damsel in distress trope, right, is something that, is it still necessary? And, does anyone need this?
And again, and does the distress have to be thrown onto the screen?
Right.
You know, there's so much that you can imply, and there's so much that you can, you know, reference, or you can make abundantly clear to the audience without lingering on violence against women.
Yeah. So anyway, obviously this is a case by case basis sort of situation, because you cannot say, well, these things can never be on screen. That, right. Then you have another production code happening. But
be better, Hollywood.
Do it better. No one is going to listen to us.
No, of course
not. No one in any power is going to listen to us.
But we
register our protest.
Yes.
Here.
One last thing I want to throw out. The thing that bugged me about Little Things, but it was a spoiler, so I can't really get into it.
Well, if it's a spoiler, it's a spoiler, because they listened all the way through.
Right. That's why I saved it for now. It's not relevant to the earlier, to the discussion we were just having about women,
right,
in film. This is something else. The movie ultimately wants you to kind of understand that, oh, you know, sometimes cops shoot the wrong person, and oh well, just part of the job, I guess.
Right. Yeah. another poorly timed message.
Yeah. I mean, there was never a good time for that, but it's especially awful now.
I know.
I know. I know. Yeah. You know. All right. Are we good? Is that it?
Are we good? No.
You know.
You're pretty good.
I'm not.
Whatever.
You, the listener, however, are awesome, especially because you made it this far. So thank you. Thank you. We'll be back next time with more. Until then,
goodbye.